podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Thanks for choosing this free Anfield Index podcast. If you'd prefer to listen to this or any of our other shows without adverts, then now's the time to check out Anfield Index Pro. With AI Pro, you can supercharge your entire listening experience. You'll not only get all of our podcasts without the ads, but you'll have them far faster with our quick publish feature available exclusively for subscribers. AI Pro also puts you in the heart of our sound studio, with an option to listen to many of our shows live and interact with the podcasters in real time as the shows are recording. Upgrading couldn't be easier. AI Pro is available on all popular podcast platforms, and we have our own apps for Apple and Android. Just head on over to AnfieldIndexPro.com and get started today.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest Anfield Index Under Pressure podcast. My name's Dan Kenner, and with me to do another international break podcast, the third one of the season, and the last one for a long, long time, thank goodness. I do have the Dynamic Sports Science duo. I've got the manual, the reason why you all listen to this show is Mr. Simon Brundish. Good evening, Si.
Evening, boys. It's exciting times. International breaks, a wank fest, but we've got a good pod.
We have got a belter of a pod, hopefully. Let's not get too ahead of ourselves, but I've got him broadcasting live from his ivory tower. It's Dr. Phil Barter, Professor of Data Science at Middlesex University. Good evening, Phil.
How are we doing, boys? Looking forward to it, as always.
Absolutely. And I have a very special treat for you all. We've got a new member of the team. He's once of this parish. I think he's still a semi-regular on AI Discord, but he used to do the Tactics Weekly podcast with Rhodesy and none of them Mr. Paul Dalgleish, but it's Hamza Kalikloonat. Good evening, Hamza.
Good evening, everyone. Not to be like cliched, but very good to be back.
Absolutely. It's been a while since you did a podcast for AI, mate.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I was on a Crick Index not too long ago with Rhodesy.
That's more important, yes.
But the last time I did an AI pod, it's been a long time. But as you mentioned, I've been in the Discord listening and watching and trying to...
Lurking, mainly, lurking.
Yes. Looking for ideas.
But you're sounding good, mate. You're nice and clear, nice silky tones. I like it. It's definitely a welcome addition to the show. But you just wanted to give us a bit about give us a bit of info about yourself, what you do, and your potted life story to get to this point.
As in real sort of long time Anfield Index regulars will know that I sort of started out. I think my first ever piece was a sort of a 3,000 or 5,000 word analysis on Brendan Rodgers and what was going wrong there. Rhodesy.
Not the 14-15 season.
I think.
Oh my goodness. Talking about going in at the deep ends. That's a toughie.
So that's where I started. And then, doing a bit of tactics, writing for a while, and then the podcast. Now I'm of the times. So I do a bit of football reporting. And I've done a couple of Liverpool matches, actually. I have asked Klopp a couple of questions, but I was actually there when the Spurs...
Was he nice to you? This is the most important thing, Hamza. Was he nice to you?
He was nice, but at the Spurs match, the look on his face was so scary. I didn't want to ask him a question. I was just looking. I was like, I'm not going to ask him that. It's because 2 minutes into the press conference, of course, and Miguel Delaney pops up and he says, the PGMOL have released a statement. And I looked at Klopp and he just had a sort of a look and I went, your first memory of me is not going to be... I hope it's not me asking a silly question here. I try and bring a bit of a sort of different approach when I'm in the presses, trying to get a bit more tactics, a bit more analytics out of the coaches. Some are quite receptive to that, some aren't. Gary O'Neill's great for that sort of stuff.
He was great on Monday Night Football, wasn't he? Gary O'Neill.
They're the sort of managers that I'll definitely recommend that you'd actually sort of listen to their full presser, because you might have a 15-minute presser and there might be 2 minutes they're actually worthwhile, but those 2 minutes are actually great. Some managers like him are great. Some other ones, some don't like to give much stuff away at all. Mikel Arteta, for example, you ask him about questions and he doesn't generally like to sort of engage with them. He's quite sort of guarded in that regard. I haven't had a chance to... Actually, Pep was all right as well. And Pep Linders, of course, is probably the best guy when it comes to sort of getting a good segment out of him.
Well, he likes to talk. Pep, Mr. Linders, doesn't he? He really likes to talk.
Definitely. but yeah, that is... I hope that's sort of a little sort of random explanation of what
Absolutely.
I do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And well, welcome aboard, mate. Well, hopefully, you know, everybody's going to have lots of kind words to say after this. But the most important thing to recognise there is that you did start out as the much maligned internet blogger. And you become expert on the internet. So, yes, it's amazing how many of these people do start off as, in quotes, internet bloggers. Anyway.
I would definitely... One thing I'd say UP was like a big part of that, because the other day... for example, Mikel Arteta was speaking about Gabriel Jesus and his load management. Ooh. and not a single person in the press conference understood what he was on about.
Mm.
And I sat there, looked around, I was like, no one else picked up on load, acute load, chronic load, some brundish stuff.
Did you ask him about the optimal ratio?
He mentioned it, and I'd already asked my question, so I just sort of took it down in my notes, and afterwards we discussed ourselves, the other journalists, like what was probably the best bit to have. And I said, this load stuff's quite good. And then you go through his minutes and you check that there's a spike there. But yeah, a lot of things people will miss just because they're not quite certain terms and ideas they're not familiar with. So often us sports journalists don't do a good enough job of translating that information. So having something like UP is actually really useful, especially for my education at least. So that's hopefully what I'm here for.
There you go. Mission accomplished, Si.
Awesome. Yeah, I knew Hamza was fully integrated into the sports science group think.
Yes. Absolutely. And a repetition, you were bemoaning rope repetition pre-pod, but that's one of the good things about repetition. You just drill it home to people. Yeah.
I suppose. I remember talking about this stuff on CNN and on ESPN.
You were wearing a nicer jacket than you are now.
It wasn't that pod, but it wasn't that interview, but yeah.
Yeah, and Phil, we always like to think this is podcast is kind of education. We've always done it with that in mind, haven't we?
Yeah, I think we've always tried to explain terms when we haven't. So it does a pretty particularly good job of bringing in a metaphor to explain it as well. But I think we're all pretty good at because I think without being too ideological, we are kind of spread the word and try and educate to become better fans. And Hams is one of the journos that takes it up and try to, in some small way, improve the reporting of games in this country.
Absolutely. Well said. Well said, mate. Anyway, we are going to crack on with our international break pod. And we're going to start, as ever, with these ones, these international break pods, with the injury situation, the all-important injury situation. Si, it wasn't looking too good before the break. Has it improved?
Good's relative, isn't it? Like, are we talking in comparison to the other teams? Are we talking in comparison to best possible case scenario? Are we talking in comparison history?
I think we have to say in context to what we can actually afford to sustain in terms of injury levels, where the squad, yeah.
That makes sense. So then it becomes much more subjective than the stuff we're dealing with. I think we've suddenly got some injuries. We've pretty much had none this season. Set aside one player from the start of 11. Just set aside Thiago. That's it.
Like, he's never going to play for us again, is he?
I hope so. My heart misses him.
I know. Andy Robbo, long term.
Robbo's got a proper injury. Robbo's going to be out till the new year for sure. Is what it is. Nothing you can do about that. That's got nothing to do with aging tissues. It's just a proper dislocated shoulder with the damage. It was bad enough that he needed surgery to put it back into the right spot. So it becomes the nature of that with how invasive surgery is compared to just putting it back and hoping it heals. You've got all of the tissue that you dig down through to get to heal as well. The actual bone might heal quicker, but it's got a much bigger wound than otherwise from falling on the floor. So I think probably the FA Cup is going to be the early, it would be his return game in best case scenario, I'd imagine. We've got
Jones.
CJ probably is probably back next week. Gomez and Kanate's fake injury, so he's going to be back next week. So you
actually think he wasn't injured, Kanate?
Honestly, I have no information about that at all. My guess is it was a little bit of a gigs thing, because why wouldn't you at this point? He is made of wet digestives, so why send him away to France when they're playing teams they can rack up 14 goals against? It's just a waste of his minutes that he's going to get injured again. I'd rather he played an extra two games for Liverpool than for France before he got injured, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So that's what I would have done if I was Klopp. But who knows at this point? He could well just be injured, and I'm pulling stuff out of my ass. Gomez has probably got a couple of weeks more.
Okay. Gomez, obviously, Bajacic, you know, we always say not to include him in these things, but he is an official squad player, injured as well. And Gravenberch is the other one.
Yep. So Grav's got an injury that kept him out of the internationals and he could be, officially he's impending, so he should be back next weekend, but let's see.
Right. And as far as you're aware, no new injuries while on international duty?
No.
Okay. So it sounds like it's going to be at least no worse than it was for the Brentford game, and hopefully better, because obviously McAllister won't be suspended. But we need to start this next block of games with the healthiest squad possible side, because this is the season, right? This block until the FA Cup, this is make or break, right?
Yeah, this is the serious time of season. We've got in the 38 days between the return against City and January the 1st, we have 9, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'd had this written down. 11 games. I can't find it on my 5 screens where I wrote it down. We've got 11 games in 38 days. It's hardcore. We have one full rest day. So match day plus 4 out in the next month and 2 weeks. So there is no time to prepare. This is all about recovery, active recovery, maybe one or two in bed days of tactics, but really not a lot going on here. You've just got to, this is the time when you should have fully prepared your squad rotation, your team rotations way ahead of advance. This is your lads that play in midfield and in midweeks. These are your lads that play midfield at weekends. Go and play.
Yeah. So 8 Premier League matches in that block.
8 Premier League matches, 2 now important Europa League games, and the bullshit Mickey Mouse game in the middle between Man United and Arsenal, because we can't help ourselves.
So the Europa League game against LASK is the big one, because if we win that, we should be qualified, which gives you at least one dead rubber, potentially.
Yeah.
And the only saving grace about the West Ham match is that it's at home in that period. So the only, you mentioned rest days, one full rest day of recovery. That's actually between the Man City and LASK game, isn't it?
Yeah, first week.
Yeah, on the Tuesday or the Wednesday, one of those days it'll be. Yeah. So you are hoping to see a weekend 11 and a midweek 11. Yeah, based on what you were saying there.
Yeah. So I what I'm hoping for is that we have pre-planned. So each of our players will have. They actually do have a typical adjusted chronic load, right? So they have their whatever chronic load they're at now, but they will have like a proven level of a capacity to play a set number of minutes a week for a set period of time. So I'll be looking at a 6-week period. What is the maximum chronic load that each player has shown they can play whilst performing well and not in getting injured. So all of the players should have a threshold of minutes played that they've demonstrated they can do in the past. And all our players do have that. I have those numbers in the past from previous seasons as well. And we have, like, some of the boys have got some massive weekly chronic loads in the past. So, like, Mo's demonstrated, he's got an average of 142 in his Liverpool career.
Wow.
In a week. That's a lot of midweek games.
Virgil has got a big history of it as well.
But centre-backs accept, you can just roll centre-backs out all the time because most of the time they don't.
Well, you say that, but then you also said that Konate's made of digestives. So
He's just an individual rather than you can't use player profiles, like position profiles against him because he just breaks. And of the least intense positions on the pitch, on the outfield pitch, he plays that and he breaks all the time.
Hmm. Yeah.
So his chronic load is less than 90 minutes a week.
Are you that person who has everything? The coolest merch and those must-have fan threads? Well, over at our Anfield Index shop, we've gone that extra mile when it comes to pimping up your Liverpool collection. From our popular range of bespoke design T-shirts, sweaters, hoodies and hats, to our signature edition mugs, prints and coasters, all provided with fast worldwide shipping. We have something for every red. We also stock official LFC merchandise and are licensed with the Premier League and UEFA to sell official iron-on shirt badges and sleeve patches. As a listener to this podcast, you can get 10% off everything with coupon code AIPRO10. Just head over to anfieldindex.shop or find us on Etsy by searching for Anfield Index.
Yeah. So we were talking about three pods ago, I think, about you were quite optimistic about where the rotation situation was. And we thought we were making a better fist of it. And then just the last few games before the international break, it kind of went a little bit awry. How optimistic that we'll stick to the science in this block? What does history tell us in this block? Do we do it better in this block, or does it give you cause for optimism that we will follow the numbers?
The season before last, it ruined everything in terms of Klopp had very obviously made some big, significant adjustments over his Liverpool career in terms of rotation, particularly through the dark winter period. And he went from playing all of his players and then breaking all of his players to rotating more and then rotating earlier and then rotating strategically all the way through the season. And we had two really good seasons of it. And then the cup run, the quad, whatever nonsense happened. And suddenly Virgil's making his debut in the Carabao Cup in September. And if we didn't have the Carabao Cup, I would be on board with it. I think we're fine. I think we're probably fine because we've got younger players that also don't have a massive injury history. But it still worries me that we're still playing to win. It feels like we haven't quite prioritised a hierarchy of importance of competition as much as I would like. And I'm the only important person in the world here, obviously.
You are the sports scientist, but
like it feels like we're taking unnecessary risk with players' load in competitions where we shouldn't. But they value obviously the lesser competitions way more than I do. I think we've even proven beyond any reasonable doubt the consequence of minutes played, as I've talked about many, many times before here, where people go, "Yeah, but you count in international minutes." Bodies don't care what shirt they're wearing. They don't care what competition they're in. A game against Shrewsbury in the Carabao Cup or a game against Real Madrid, it's very, very close in terms of how much damage you're doing to the skeletal system the stresses inside the body over the course of the next week. So you layer that on to previous stress on the body. It doesn't matter who you're playing against. It's just it gradually builds and builds and builds. And at some point, most of our players break do you really want that to be part of the cause?
Hmm. So what did you say it was? 11 games in 38 days?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Bart, anything you want to come in on just to... on the rotation and how you
I agree. So I think we should have prioritised getting back in the top four, the league. Yeah, and to be fair, a lot of us are still looking at that going, hang on, our points per game, we're only 3 points off the top. You could have made a strategic decision even now and said, you know what, let's give this a shot. You could have done that as a side. I know we've set cycle aside, but you know what I'm saying, we're in a very good position. You can say, look, we won't worry about the West Ham game. The cup competition that I would have prioritised myself would have been the Europa League, because it gets you a route into Champions League, which is the ultimate goal for this season, right? But having said the rest of that, I don't understand why we've burnt Mo's minutes in that, we've burnt various other senior players in that tournament, when we know that Mo's going away to AFCON this season. Yeah. And we know actually when it came to the crunch time in that season that we label the infamous quad season, our key players were, I'm not saying fatigue, pretty harsh, but they weren't quite. Look at Champions League final in Paris. Yeah. Mo had a couple of opportunities where you don't know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but if he hadn't played those minutes earlier on in the season, you never know, he might finish that one-on-one with Courtois later on. It's those kind of situations that I really hope.
I think it's a good point.
Later on.
Last time we went to AFCON, that was the most barren period of Mo Salah's Liverpool career, wasn't it, when he came back for about 2 months? Back,
yeah. He couldn't score. I think he was still operating, he was still giving us options as a side, but he wasn't as redundant.
No.
Not redundant, sorry. You know what I'm saying. I wasn't as involved.
Yeah. Hamza, you know, you get the opportunity to ask these kind of questions about, you know, fixtures congestion and you know, injuries to Premier League managers. What's the kind of, you know, what's your takeaway on how managers approach these kind of packed schedules?
I think it does depend, but I think with Klopp in particular, I very much get the sense that he doesn't want to ever sort of give up on his idea that every match should be won. That's a core intrinsic value to him, and that underpins his principles. I think it is one of his principles. So I think even when he rotates teams, he sends them out as any sort of self-respecting professional would, with the intention to win and to play his way and to dominate. So I think that is that sense of pride, which to some degree has come at the cost of success in the league. It makes him who he is, and it makes Liverpool who they are to a degree. And I think that's also true in Manchester City as well. They usually they do rotate, but they've got a team that usually goes out and wins a League Cup, and it's important for them because they say, "Yeah, we've got a trophy," and that's part of their identity to dominate as much as they can, to always put the pressure on, even when they're not playing well. I know the City have won another trophy. It piles pressure on in a way that. That sort of monopolises, and so I think that is very, very important to the psyche of a manager. And even though they may be getting advice from the sports scientists all the time, that a player may be pushing the red zone or the team may be in trouble down the line, they see the match in front of them and say, "We have to win that, because at the end of the day, that's another trophy on the wall."
So going back to Mikel Arteta and talking about Gabriel Jesus, what was his? What do you think his plan is then to reintroduce Jesus? How do you think he will approach it? Did he say?
So he actually mentioned that Jesus's load at Arsenal is very different to what it was at City, because at City he was rotated regularly. If he started a match, he would often come off around the 60-minute mark. He wouldn't play three matches a week.
Nope.
Whereas what he's been expected to do at Arsenal is quite different. They want him to play 90s. I think the period just before he got injured, he started three games or four games in a row, and then he got injured. And he also had the internationals with Brazil as well, where he started again. The idea for him, I think, is to build up that load, in which case...
Sounds a bit Naby Keita-y to me. You know, they kind of, you know, you want to build it up, but it never quite arrives, and he just takes one setback to undo it all.
Yeah. I think with certain players, that's just sort of how they're built, sadly. I mean, Cater's,
Jesus is a great example because he has got a big injury history. But when you're a squad player at City and you can come in and be really good for 60 minutes and then that's it, and that's your expectation, that's a completely different ballgame, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think most managers, Hamza, will kind of just, they know the issues, they know the risks, but they just basically just choose to put the fingers in the plug socket, as Si always says, and then they just wait and then they just kick the can down the road and worry about it then?
I think it's a probably slightly unkind way of saying it in terms of kicking the can down the road, but I think they see their players, and as much data as they get, often they will see the data and they'll go, but I'm seeing this player in training, and the player's feedback to me often, which is quite important. If the player says, yeah, I'm ready, I can play, I want to play, and they always want to play, that does feed into it. And those, as much as especially us, we like to take a sort of colder analytical sort of view of how these processes work out, often when a player is just banging on the door, I want to play. Mohamed Salah, for example, wants to play in Europa League, and you're looking, why does he need to play? But he wants to score. He wants to break records. To those players and their psyche as well, that's quite important. So I think it's a bit more of that human element as well. There's that pride that professional players have, where they want to be as effective as possible. They want to play as many games as possible. They want to win. So I think that also feeds into it, as well as sort of managers looking at the data and go, yeah, we'll take a risk there.
Si, players. They'll never say they're not going to play, will they?
Bunch of wankers. They're children. That's the bottom line. They're children. Do you trust your 14-year-old that I'll be fine to drive? Don't worry. They're just children. You've got to take that responsibility away from you. Listen to them. They're one of the inputs.
Yeah.
They're probably more important than their HRV alone. But you still take that into account. What you do take into account more should be their history of... So one of the things that sports scientists do would be every morning they have to do an RPE. So they chart RPE, which is a rate of perceived exertion, and there are various factors, numbers involved in this, right? So most clubs will give a 1 to 10, and it will be how well did you sleep last night? Some clubs have... I have some tech monitoring that, but they'll also ask the player how hard was training after training, and they'll give that a 1 out of 10. How sore are your muscles today, right? And they'll factor those things in against both internal loading metrics like heart rate data, like sometimes they'll have some other physiological tools like CK testing, creatine kinase, which is it shows stress in the system against their norms. Or so we know physically within, I don't know, the ballpark what's going on in their body compared to previous days and compared to previous seasons. And they have a relationship with that and against how hard they say it was, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you'll get some players that run their absolute nuts off and go, and they'll do, for your example, in a match, they'll run 13K and go, oh, it was a 4. And others do 7.5 and go, that was a 10. But they always say it's a 10, no matter how hard the training session was. And the others always say it was a 4, no matter how hard the training session was. Does that make sense? So you can't trust players individually other than against their previous history. So you have to plot it against their how they always speak.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, guys. Si, you did a fatigue index pod early in the week. I recommend everybody listens to this, also goes and listens to that. You've just posted the latest fatigue index numbers, updated with some international break news. There's a few standouts there, not least our new number 8, who donned his Superman cape for Hungary a couple of days ago.
How good was he?
Yeah.
Apart from how good is he?
Yeah.
Like, it was, I don't know, most people are not going to remember this, but like, he is at least at this moment in time, Hagi or Stoichkov for the Eastern Bloc teams. Like, a generational, like, wonder already. And he just did the most Salah moment of getting his team qualified.
Oleg blocking.
Well, they had a few of those, but Russia had a few decent players. But he just did on his own. He did Beckham against Greece. The thing that the thing that the newspapers say Beckham did, and the blonde 50-year-old ladies, not the thing he actually did, but a much better version than the thing that they say he did, because he scored two wonder goals and he was utterly brilliant and he stayed in his position. But the outcome's the same. He got them qualified and unbelievable. He's just such a good player.
Another
in
one.
In this regard, we're thrashing his nuts off.
Yeah. Ziggy Boniek, one of our Polish listeners.
There you go, for Juve fans.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right, Stojkovic.
Yes.
We've got loads of them.
Yeah. So, bad news is, Si, he's played a lot this season already, right?
Yeah.
Huge amount. Club and country. What's his total minutes already for the season?
He is at 1,900, basically. But he's already at... So it's a standalone number. It doesn't mean anything. He's already at 81% of his average, of his career average. And it's a 40... Basically, it's a 40%... He is on target for a 40% increase on his career max.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't be increasing any... You shouldn't be increasing more than 20% year on year.
Yeah.
That's a massive stressor, and he did it last year. So 2 years in a row is a huge red flag.
Yeah.
Like, even Superman, the greatest, like Mo Salah, the greatest available players, Luis Suarez, you're still sticking your finger in the socket if you're doing that.
Yeah. Anybody else who really stands out on fatigue index for you, Si? Any other red flags?
He's my biggest worry at this point. Mac, coming off a World Cup year where he basically doubled. He added 2,000 minutes to his previous highest.
Yeah.
Which is a typical Thiago season. He's currently on target for 36% more than increase than his maximum. And he's already 77% of his career average.
Yeah.
So they are phenomenal. They are great athletes. They are in the prime of their lives, but we are still like, this is not a guarantee that they're going to break at all, but this is a risk for sure.
Yeah. And despite Darwin's various little knocks he's had this season, he's on course as well for a big increase on his career max as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's on target for a 34% increase of his career max, which is high. It's definitely high for a uber fast twitch player like he is. He's on for 46% above his career average. So you're talking three really, really exciting players. Can just spot Diaz in there. I know we're talking numbers here that people can't see, but Diaz at 50, he's already 51%. So we are 33% of the season gone.
Yeah.
At 51% of his career average, how little he's played, his career average is nothing.
Yeah. And we're not even at Christmas, are we? Crazy. No. Yep. There's a lot to manage there. That's a lot to manage, Si.
Yeah. So it's going to require, I want these lads fit. I want them banging 4,500 minute seasons out, but you have to build it up. You can't just expect it every season. I want these guys to be the best for the next 3 years, not just right now before Christmas. Do you know what I mean?
Yep. Very good. Anyway, we're going to move on. We're going to move on to the latest review of Liverpool on the season so far, and then we're going to come on in a bit to do a little bit on our rivals as well. And Bart, she's been a busy boy looking at our where we are now and how hot or not we are. And he's done a couple of nice Monte Carlos that you want to start off with, I think.
Yeah, if you want to. I regularly do a sort of Monte Carlo every now and again if I've got the time. But I split it by home and away. Just as a sort of, it's 12 games as well, 1,000 sims, so fairly decent amount of simulation with the XGA and XG. And this is fairly in line with a lot with understat, to be fair, but for home, we are overperforming defensively, which is something we probably know about, but we should have conceded 6 goals and we only conceded 2. So that's something we know we're running hot defensively, but it's particularly at home. That's a 4-goal difference. In terms of scoring though, at home we are under by 1 goal. So it's probably just about in line in terms of our scoring. Away from home, I think listeners will remember from previous pods we've done about this, our away form last season was a particular concern in the MCs, because we've only conceded, 7 goals away from home, but we should have conceded 10. And we should have scored 11 goals, but only scored 9. So our underperformance and overperformance are probably, I would say, worse, if you like, away from home. But that's the MCs. It's only a simulation. It's not, as some people say, it's not, a game's not made on paper.
So the most unlikely outcome there was the goals conceded at home of those.
Yeah, that's okay. The most unlikely. Yeah, that's a 4-goal swing defensively, which we've covered on pods before. Mm. With this even the last pod, Brentford missed two. An XT chance, which should have been converted into a decent XG chance, and the chance before at 0-0, and it was a 0.3, wasn't it, or something, where he put what with Ali made the save. So there's we know there's opportunities where Ali's been amazing, and your position equally haven't taken the opportunity that presented them in the form of XT.
Yeah. Now you've also done a more detailed stats pack, which you've uploaded to Under Pressure Discord for subscribers as well. And is there any highlights or anything positive, any real positives out there which look sustainable and good? And on the flip side, anything that, you know, is maybe red flags or setting some alarm bells running for you?
I think the away form for me is a concern. I think if you look at a lot of our shot maps are changed markedly home and away, not only down to the goals, but where the XGs in the periods are caused. It's a concern, and what we're letting the opposition do as well would be a worry. Also, in terms of our passing, this doesn't sound like a lot, right? But at home, we average 3 passes per minute. Okay. That's what we've done at home. Mm-hmm. And we let the opposition do a pass a minute, right? Mm-hmm. But when we go away from Anfield, it equals out 2 each. So that might not sound a lot, but actually, when you think about that in a game, that's turned into an equal contest rather than a not. In terms of, as you know, I can break down XG by situation. The other concerning thing away from home is we concede more on corners away from home than we do at home. So it's over
that seems
one.
Random.
XG.
Oh wow. Okay.
Over 1xG away from home.
Yeah.
Whereas pretty much at home, which might be in line with us running hot, we also have kept pretty much every opportunity apart from open play to below 1xG XGA. So that's not a bad thing to have. Obviously, our stats improve home versus away. We're better on corners and the rest of it at home in terms of XG production. But our open play is largely the same. It's the same profile of situation. So we have the same tools, should we say, home and away, but the degree at which we create XG is reduced away from home. So the only one that's notably above anything decent, as in 1xG, is open play away from home. So the opposition for me are limiting us to, they're saying, go on in, create in open play against us, and then they're putting a deep block up, and then they're only allowing, then they're reducing the amount we can pass the ball around as well. So that's probably something that is from those first 12 games, something I just noticed from running the usual viz. The other thing before I let others come in is, pass maps, I changed this around, sort of made it, normally it's 4 passes to get a connection, but because you're dealing with, you know, 12 games, you had to reduce that down, had to increase that, sorry, to reduce noise. What that does mean is our shape, I know it's average position, but we've spoken about this a lot, away from home is incredibly narrow. It's in the middle 3 channels of the pass network on the image.
So it's
of the
all, between the width, all between the width of the penalty.
All with the 18-yard box. And that's particularly pertinent with our inverting right back. Whereas if you look in the home version, we have representation in both the outside channels, as I would say, and we have good depth and width in the middle areas as well. So there's a distinct change in our patterns in terms of our position and our pass networking away from home versus home. Left hand side still try and hold the width, but our right hand side is particularly more is narrower narrower, is that a word?
Narrower.
There you go. Away from home. The other thing as well, annoyingly, which probably goes the setups we're facing at home, we've got our front three players in half spaces in zone 14, key areas for us to produce from. Away from home, largely, if you look at the attacking networks, they're kept out of those areas away from home. So that's just some things with the tactics to think about. But yeah, that's a plenary of things I've looked at for the moment.
Nice. Thank you, Phil. I just want to talk about a couple of players, one very quickly, and then another more in depth. So the first one is Virgil. There was a nice article in The Athletic from Simon Hughes about the narrative was very much that Virgil is back, but maybe not in his homeland, where he's still being rather heavily criticised by some ex-profile players like Ruud Gullit, Marco van Basten, and amongst others. But very much domestically. The famous dribble pass stat made a reappearance, Phil, which I quite like to remember. I remember. I think it was Nicolas Pepe, didn't he? He won the dribbled pass trophy.
He did. His only thing he's won is Arsenal, hasn't it? Before he's now, after his £90 million move and the rest of it. But, yeah.
So Simon's got the numbers here. It's 54 attempts to dribble past Virgil and only one. And this is between 2018 and his injury in 2020. And only one player made it out the other side against him out of 54 attempts. That was Pepe. Yeah. And then in the next three seasons since then, post-injury, 23, this includes the near quad season, 23 out of 89 dribbles against Virgil have been successful, which it's not quite a third, about 28%, I think, if my maths is right. But this season, 10 Premier League matches, 13 dribbles against him, only one player's come out the other side. And as well as he's got the best tackle percentage in the league on Opta, and he's also miles ahead in aerial tours. He's having his most dominant season ever in the air for Liverpool.
Jeez. Be interesting to see whether it's what those stats are like. I know the sample size will be even smaller, but the post red card.
Yeah.
We said last week, didn't we? We thought his performance had gone up post the red card.
Yeah.
So that'd be interesting. But no, there's certainly stats that are showing he's coming back to something. Whether he's fully there or not, he's probably a little bit way to go. Whether he'll ever get fully back there, but still certainly improvements from the last season and other periods.
Yeah. And the other one I want to talk about in a bit more depth, because it's so important, both tactically and statistically and everything wise, is Trent. I know Si's got some strong views on Trent at the moment, which is good because we'll have a nice balanced discussion. And I think where I want to start this is Trent as an individual and then Trent as part of the team context. And one thing I did myself was I went back through the match logs on FBref and assembled the data of him playing in the hybrid role in the WM. And he's played 1,759 minutes. And this follows on from the discussions we've had on the last two podcasts, basically. 1,759 minutes, 25 through balls. And that's 1.3 through balls per 90. And we always say through balls are the most valuable type mm-hmm. of chance created. Typically, the average shot he's got a 10% conversion, whereas the average through ball chance is more than double that. And so, you know, it's about 22% conversion on average for a through ball chance.
Nearly a big chance, isn't it?
Which is huge. When you can, you know, you're looking at over 100% improvement or 10 percentage points is massive.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very few players get to 1.3 through balls per 90 minutes. So Lionel Messi's done it about six times in the course of his career. He's a couple of seasons he's had over two per game. Kevin De Bruyne's done it once in 2017-18 season. And Neymar Jr., when Neymar was actually quite good between 2017-18 and 2019-20. And he had some ridiculous numbers there, even better than Messi on some of the creativity numbers for PSG. But that's it. No one else has reached that level of creativity. So Trent is doing these things individually, and there was one against Luton, which we didn't score from, which was the one we talked about a lot because it was the Darwin. Yeah. Darwin got a great first touch, but then he hit the bar, didn't he? But, you know, that's a really good example of a three-ball chance which Trent creates. But the overall team context is that if we look in terms of expected threat, at least, the overall team output in attack is no more than it's been in previous years for us. Trent's individual numbers are great, but the defensive numbers are all at their worst levels that they have been for us. It's still significantly worse than the previous four seasons. So how do we square the circles, Bart? How do we marry the strengths of doing this versus the weaknesses of it?
Hello, I'm here to annoy you. I'm here to annoy you into listening to more of me and more of others on EPL Index. We don't just have the Anfield Index stuff. We've got EPL Index as well, which covers the entirety of the Premier League. And we have three podcasts and a whole bunch of really good writing on EPLindex.com. The podcasts are my own two-footed podcast, which is every day at 4 p.m., Monday through Friday, covering the whole league. We have A Tad Predictable, hosted by Tadiwa. You know Tadiwa, he does Anfield Index. He presents A Tad Predictable before every Premier League match week. And then Kevin DeVries and his crew on the EPL Roundtable, they're every week after the Premier League match week. So make sure you listen to everything we're doing on EPL Index and follow us there on Twitter at EPL Index. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I think this, you've clearly made a case. The strengths are that if he produces that three ball game, that's pretty much a big chance, right?
Yeah.
So that in itself is a big opportunity. If you look at positionally, we've chatted about this a lot defensively, particularly away from home. If you know, with the touch maps, he's more inverted inside, so we are more exposed. But the other thing to note is the position he's taken up inverted is a less XT opportunity to create than if he was high and wide in the hot zone. So his XT production will go down as a result of inverting, because those squares in the 192 by 192 grid of XT calculations are worth less than if he was out in the hot zones or his other areas that we were successful for in terms of winning the league and the Champions League. So that's going to be a reduction. But in terms of his actual direct XG production, the trade-off is that he's got more opportunity to create that as a higher volume. Does that make sense? So So he creates that through ball, which has got a higher end XG chance, versus if he was in the usual areas, he would get a higher XT because those boxes are worth more. But there's a trade-off. Defensively, we've spoken about that. Whether we need a six to play with him, or whether we need to get by a right back. I think, as I said in one of our chats the last week, you know, just buy a right back and tell Trent to play in the middle, as England are doing. But I think it's what you want him to do from an output. And then I think we've all discussed the fact that at the moment the side is too set up to get him to do this one particular thing, and maybe not covering for the defensive areas that he's now not able to do, because we're asking him to go in there, and he's going there at an increasing rate as well, as in the middle of the park.
Yeah. So Hamza, you've had a chance to talk about Trent inverting, the WM three box three. What's your whole take on it?
I think that the long and short of it is there's upsides and downsides. And you can't get away from that. I mean, so like this season, if we use our friend Mark stats, I think he's top for non-cross XT. I think it's 0.23.
Absolutely.
And in that level, I think is only sort of comparable to Kevin De Bruyne in recent seasons.
Yeah. And that's his Trent's second best season on that basis as well. That, you know, on that metric as well. So.
But at the same time, so while his XT is up, his XA is down. I think two seasons ago, in the quadruple charge season, he was going to get 0.41 XA per 90, which again, that's I think the only time where he's actually rivaled Kevin De Bruyne in terms of XA per 90.
Yeah.
And the reason that's impressive is because obviously he's a fullback and he's not an attacking midfielder. And sometimes we forget that element.
Absolutely.
That's why it's so impressive. So you've got a few things going on there. So in terms of actual delivery into the box, you're not getting that quality anymore. And there's a few things to unpack if he's playing in midfield. So right now, the England match is actually on. And he's sort of playing a double pivot, but he's actually as a number eight. And in the previous match, he also played as a number eight in one half and then in a double pivot in the other half. And they are two slightly different. Often they can be very, very similar, but slightly different roles, and they get different things out of him. But the question is the trade-off of having him there better than having him at fullback? And at the moment, I'm still not sure that's the case. When you have such an extraordinary player in terms of output, like I said, with that season where he got 0.41 XA per 90, I think you should be looking to maximize the ability to use that. And when he's in these deeper areas, while you are getting the switches of plays, while you are getting the sort of the improvements of tempo, I mean, Szoboszlai can offer switches.
Yeah,
McAllister can offer can control tempo. If Thiago's there, he offers both, but he usually isn't. Virgil offers switches from deep as well, from left to right, but we're not often seeing the right to left one, which is important when you're playing against low blocks. You need to manipulate space. There's a few games this season where we've seen that Liverpool have compacted the middle and they're playing through the middle, and it's just Salah out wide, and you see a 2-on-1 matchup out wide, and you're thinking, well, Salah might be able to take two players on. But why don't you increase the percentage chances of him doing that, of having success on that side, by offering the overlapping run, by having Trent combined with him, by having him in proximity? And again, I'm going to come back to England. When Trent plays near Saka, things happen. But if Trent is playing far away from him, it's less likely to happen. Having these players in close proximity to one another, so where they can do that instinctive manipulation of the ball, where they can rotate when they see spaces and move into them, because that's their instincts as a footballer rather than a sort of tactical scheme that's set up for them. I think that's where you get the best out of him. And he's actually coming off right now. I don't think this is his best match for England.
I appreciate the live updates there, Hamza, anyway.
I think it's a complicated issue, and I think we'd actually be better using him in a sort of more tailored manner. For example, if you're playing against a low block and you've already got McAllister and Szoboszlai playing, you should use him as a fullback.
Do you think the Brentford match may be a precursor of that, where it was a more balanced distribution between playing out wide as a fullback, traditional fullback, and then inverting? It wasn't the mad dash to invert at every single opportunity.
Before I make a judgment on that, I'd just like to see it a bit more, because just one game, you see things, and everything is sort of a contingent when it's one game. So good-ish signs there, but you can't jump to the conclusion yet on that.
Very wise words, Hamza. Very wise words. Yeah, absolutely. I fully agree. Brundish, you're not convinced. You're less convinced than most on this experiment, still, aren't you?
I don't think the numbers match up. I appreciate what you're saying about through balls, but okay, through balls are more likely to cause a high XG shot
and a big chance. Yeah,
but they're not. He's created 5 big chances this season, 2 of which were from corners.
Yeah.
So I don't care how many through balls he's making if the through ball is not creating a big chance. Is that the one statistic we can hang our hat on, that it's worth? Can we all agree that there is disruption from him playing there?
Absolutely.
It's not making us structurally more sound.
No. My point was that the team attack is good, but it's been good for the past 5 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the attack isn't better than it has been. In fact, it's still a chunk below where it was in 21-22 season, right?
Yeah.
But the defence is worse than all the previous seasons.
Ah, so if we can go back to if we can look at what Bartz was talking about, like, you know, trends this season,
yeah,
our rolling 10 right now Okay. So Bart's actually pointed out something. I'm just jumping off the Trent thing for a second. Bart asked something in the WhatsApp a couple of weeks ago. I vaguely grasped it and then forgot completely because I live with my hair on fire, which is the reason I have none. He wanted me to compare XT against post shot, which I do anyway. I have this in the table. And rolling 19 of XG... of expected threat against versus the quality of shot Ali has to save.
Yeah.
Post shot. Yeah. We over 38 games, we are 0.03. So our defense is saving 0.03 of the expected threat that translates into a shot to goal that Ali's got to save. But in the last 10 games, it's minus 0.39. So it's literally 10 times better. It's not, 10 times is 0.03 is not a massive deal, but 0.39 is the contribution of our defense saving the expected threat before the quality of shot Ali gets. It's a small sample size. It's only 10 games.
Mm. But that's a big chance, though, isn't it?
It's a big chance. And our two best seasons was 0.31. So our defense currently is performing like it actually a little bit better than it did. This is before Ali. This is not even the bit Ali does. This is the bit that Ali has to face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're getting expected threat, but we're already nullifying the quality of that. We talked about this last season, that the opposition were getting lots of chances. No, not many chances, but the chances they were getting were really high quality.
Yeah.
And then they were converting that into a really high quality post shot, and now they're not.
Yeah.
So our defense is doing something much better than they were last season, whatever that is.
Or the midfield is,
up for debate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something is happening to suppress the shot quality that Ali has to face, which is about as good as it gets. When we were the best team in the world, we had the best. Two best boxers in the world. We were the best forwards and the best defense inside both penalty areas. This season, we're much better at controlling midfield, kind of. But that's been the target for us. And we were not necessarily that great at one of the ends. Ali is the best in the world, so he's always going to make that up. But so my point is the defense is actually better. And it probably goes to one of the points I missed out on that you're chatting about. Virgil has been better, without a shadow of a doubt. I don't think he's what he used to be. I think the tackle stat is bullshit. I think because it's subject. Let me say
the
award of a tackle is subjective.
Yes.
So during games, three games this season, when I've recorded what Opta said was a tackle, Virgil had missed five tackles. But then he got corrected afterwards. So he's not missed any. But at one point, Opta rewarded him missing five.
Wow. Is a tackle not against the art of defending where you avoid having to make a tackle as well?
Of course it does. He's not made that many tackles. But
you know what I mean? That's why I don't like Mitch.
It's nonsense. It's always nonsense. Virgil's brilliant. Virgil's less brilliant than he used to be. But thankfully, he was shit last season. Now he's not great. Yeah.
So the change is massive.
And going back to that thing, as I'm catching up on the previous tangents, that I think it's probably been between the international breaks when he's been looking like Virgil, and the last time we heard from those famous old Dutch players was the last international break, and he had been kind of shit for about a year and a half. So I think it's fair enough if that's what they're seeing of him.
Yeah,
they just haven't caught up with the news yet. That's all. But going back to Trent, I don't think his... So his XG build, here's my massive shitload of tangents because I was counting up all this stuff. His XG build per 90 is the same now, 0.48 as it was last season, 0.49, shit season before, but it was 0.52 season before that one. We were really good. So that was right back. The stuff before the actual goal stuff, the end product, is below what he was managing at right back.
Yeah.
And the actual stuff, the output stuff, that's way below what he was managing at right back. And we're not controlling games better by creating more stuff. So I'm really not sure what the point is, other than
all grassroots coaches in the fucking world are making inverted fullbacks right now. Mm.
Yeah. So I wanted to build on what you say there, Si, because I think there is a story in the defensive numbers. And if we look at, I've got about 8 or 10 measures on that I've researched and coming into this. And there's a real curate's egg of a combination here, is that our opponents have got the lowest shot conversion in the league against us this season. 6%. 6% shot conversion. I mean, that is not sustainable, right? We are now hotter than Spurs defensively. I didn't think that would be possible. After the way we talked about Spurs a couple of pods ago. So the league average shot is converted at a 10% rate, and we are four percentage points lower than that. I've never known us be like that. But the bad news is that is not sustainable. However, the average distance from our goal, we are the second best team in the league in terms of how far away from goal the opposition takes their shots. It's 17.8 metres on the average shot. The only team which is better than us is Arsenal, 18 metres. Now, the problem is, I think, here, is that a lot of the games is because it's still only 12 games, and that's why I'm going to come back to XT, is that the opposition have had big chances inside our box which haven't really resulted in anything. For example, the most famous one of all is the Mateus Cunha header at Wolves, which I don't think was even given as a shot in the end by Opta. So this season, in all Premier League games in expected threat, we are 1.94 in attack and 1.3 defensively, which is a difference of 0.64 per game, which is good. That's top four good, right? People say, well, what about the red cards? And what about the red cards? Well, what about the red cards? Because the attack, when it's 11v11, the biggest impact is on the attack. When it's 11v11, we are 2.1 expected threat instead of 1.9, but we barely move the needle. We're 1.26 defensively versus 1.3. So the underlying defensive numbers don't really change whether it's red card or 11v11. And they are RXT defensively is over 50% worse than Man City and almost 40% worse than Arsenal. So I think there's a really interesting story in these defensive numbers. We're still conceding two big chances per game, which is better than last season, but not good enough yet. But yeah, it just looks to me we're conceding too many opportunities for the opposition to get into the dangerous positions, which at some point they will start taking. And I think the opposition to do a few pot shots or a few low percentage chances to go in, because I don't think we can sustain 6% opposition shot conversion. Anybody want to come back to me on that?
One thing I'll add quickly. I remember last season when Liverpool were playing quite badly, the non-penalty XG per shot face was 0.14. It ended the season at 0.13, and now on FB Ref it's 0.1, but I don't think it shows the full decimal places.
League average, that's more like, yeah, league average rate.
I think it's just five teams have a better non-penalty XG per shot against.
Yes.
West Ham, Wolves, Arsenal, Everton and Newcastle. But yeah, I just wanted to give that stat in because the non-penalty XG last season was the number to match with the discussion that we just had earlier, sorry.
Yeah. But?
Yeah, I was going to make a similar point. I was just saying that average XG we give away at home per shot is 0.09, and away it goes up to nearly 0.12.
Yeah.
So that's a marginal difference, but that's kind of comes back to what you're saying about the long distance shot. And you kind of see that in the shot maps when you see it. When we're away from home, it's not that different, but there's a lot more shots on the outside of the area. I know we're away from home, we're inviting somebody, but it's just a different kind of makeup. And I think, as I've said already, I think our away form and our ability to reduce the XT and the XG away from home, I think could be the difference in us doing a big thing this season and not, personally. Because I think our XG, I think at home, if you look at our home form, our home, what we give out at home, I think that's where we are riding hot, but I think we're performing pretty damn well at home. If all the metrics point that way, but away from home. But then we've also had red cards, haven't we? So I don't know.
I think it's fair to say overall, if we're having this context now, we're having a really hard look at numbers after 12 games and saying, these aren't a million miles away from Man City and Arsenal.
No, they're not. It's just a slight difference.
Yeah, it's just a different. We're a different profile team. We're better in attack and worse defensively. But the overall difference, you know, in terms of XG difference or XT difference between us and Arsenal is the same number. It's just a different profile.
Yeah, but I think your point about XT is key, because we're below Arsenal and City, aren't we, from XT? So I think that's probably something to look at. But then that's something to, we've said before. Our midfield has improved this season. But as Si said, we're still not controlling games as well as we used to in midfield. It is improved, but we're still not there. You know, hand on heart, have we gone into a game and completely shut it down after a period of time? I don't think we have. You know, even Brentford, it was a 3-0 win, but we all said it was a bit weird, and there was garbage time XG given up, which we weren't doing at our best.
Exactly, and it seems to be more reliant on a certain combination of personnel to be able to shut stuff down if we can as well.
We
can't really shut it down with, you know, the B team or, you know, reserved players on the list.
No, for sure.
Si, last word to you on this one.
I could talk about Ali all day, but we already know he's the greatest.
No, we do. No, that is unequivocal.
Do you know what? No, I'm going to go there. Ali is so good compared to the other keepers that it covers up for all of this other stuff you're talking about. He has faced 24 big chances this season and saved 11 of them.
It's phenomenal.
The next, Kaminski, who is Luton, I had no idea what his name was, but Luton's has faced the most with 46, as you'd expect, and saved 15. Of the competition from who we're going for the league with, you have Arsenal are saving 18% of their big chances, whoever's in goal for them average, and City are currently saving... Sorry, my bad. I had this before. So 20.
The fundamental...
Half as good as Ali.
Yeah. Absolutely. Fundamentally, the difference between us and the other two teams, the other two really good teams, is that they allow much less volume on their goal, right? We allow much more volume, but we have a brilliant goalkeeper.
Yeah. Yeah. But imagine if we didn't allow that volume.
Yeah. Yeah. And have
imagine
a brilliant
if we
goalkeeper.
Could just, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Imagine if we could just get the midfield right to get back to controlling it a bit more. I think this side would go from being where we're like, yeah, well, we're kind of there. We're 3 points off the top, being, no, actually, we're the best team in the country. And that's what I find frustrating at times. Is I don't think we're actually that far away. The metrics are all pointing the right way. It's just this little bit here, which I think we're all kind of in agreement with. We give away too much XT. We give away too much volume of opportunity to create those XGA. And that, I think, is preventing us from potentially winning the league.
Yeah.
Personally.
Let's talk a bit about our rivals. Going to bring Hamza in a second.
Can I just stand up here? Just to support that, I didn't realise. Fucking hell. Who else is there to compete with? Like, we've got City. We can pretend Arsenal are in this. Okay, I'm Arsenal. I'm not having anybody else is in any competition for the league. Right? Yeah. With... my God, I can't fathom it. When goal
of not them are a myth, is that what we're saying?
They're overperforming both. Yeah,
blows my mind. But goal difference at 0-0, the Arsenal concede 0.78, City 0.78. Liverpool 0.135, double. So there's Ali for you. So basically, we've neutralised Ali.
Yeah,
yeah. But the one thing we can all agree on is that to go to contend on a title run deep into the season, Ali has to be just play like this every game. We can't afford Ali to drop even a little bit, can we?
This season, no.
We can't. That's a lot of pressure on him, even though he is brilliant. Right. let's talk about our rivals. And I just want to start off. And I said I did give some bad news about a big red flag for me on in how hot we were running. Another one for City, though, is that their opposition goalkeepers against Man City are easily the worst in the entire league. They've let in 4.5 more goals than they should have through their post shot. 4.5 in 12 games. That's not going to fucking continue for that much longer. So hopefully we'll see a bit like Chelsea have suffered from, where I think they're at the other stage where they've saved 4 more than they should have as well. So so hopefully that we see a bit more of a swing there against Man City. But coming to you, Hamza, because I think you've got some stuff on Man City and Arsenal.
I don't need a VPN. I've got nothing to hide. This is what I used to tell myself before I hooked up with LibertyShield.com. Not only is my home internet now fully encrypted, but I can now access all the websites I want, whenever I want, and do so from absolutely anywhere. As a Liverpool fan, I love to know I can now watch every match, regardless of whether it's on UK TV or not. My Liberty Shield VPN makes sure nothing is blocked and guarantees me super fast streaming speed throughout that match. You can get connected right now with their software package, which includes a 48-hour no-obligation free trial and instant access to their apps for Apple, Android, Fire TV, PC, Mac, and Android TV. Or go a step further like I have and get one of their pre-configured VPN routers. These small but powerful devices allow you to easily connect every device in your home to VPN, making it the perfect solution for smart TVs, Mac boxes, and games consoles. Visit LibertyShield.com today and use coupon code AIVPN25 to get 25% off at checkout.
Yeah, that's right. And what I'll do, I'll quickly just mention just a couple of goalkeeper stats because they are relevant to what we've just mentioned and what we're leading on to. So in terms of goals per shot on target this season, opponents against Liverpool are going at 0.19, best in the league. Against Manchester City, it's 0.32, which is just about middle in the league. And then against Arsenal, it's 0.35. Which is the second worst in the league. Only
is that
Burnley
because their goalies are rubbish?
Yeah. Well, I think, well, statistically speaking, Aaron Ramsdale has almost always been a below average shot stopper. And David Raya, I think, is generally a good goalkeeper. I wouldn't put him in top sort of bracket, but he's a good goalkeeper, good all round distribution. Claiming the ball, I think just the situation.
He's under pressure, though, isn't he? The Brexiteers are on his case because he's keeping Aaron Ramsdale at the team, and he's under a lot of pressure.
Pretty much that doesn't help him. But to lead into our comparison with our rivals, one thing that as we know, Arsenal and Manchester City are particularly sort of miserly. They don't give much away, and that's reflected in set pieces too. Arsenal conceded 1.51. set piece XG, excluding penalties.
All season?
The league. Yep.
Wow.
And 17 shots as well, which, wow, I didn't quite realise how impressive that was. Yeah, 17 shots from set pieces all season. Manchester City have the second best record, 24 set piece shots and a 2.52 set piece XG. Liverpool are lower mid-table for these figures, 3.9. XG faced and 46 shots from them. It's way above.
Wow, we've conceded 46 shots from set plays. Wow.
Yeah.
What did you say Arsenal's was? 17?
17.
Fucking hell.
Which is, as in, their defence is extraordinary. So I did a bit of research a little while ago, and their defence is only very, very... So if you use a sort of... 10-match rolling average just in that period leading up to May 2022, they dropped below 0.71 XG, non-penalty, per 90. And that's where they're at the moment. That defence is just unbelievable. But at the same time, they're experiencing something really weird. So if you've watched Arsenal this season, you can just see they're playing in a very different way. It's just immediately obvious in the first game of the season. I was there against Forest and then Fulham as well. They build up in a different way. It's much slower. It's more considered. And one slight tangent here, Liverpool are playing a lot more direct this season as well. The Opta Analyst site has this this matrix where you can see the direct speed.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Only Luton, Nottingham Forest and West Ham play in a more fast and direct fashion than Liverpool, which people just might find interesting. Yeah. But to come back to Arsenal, they're playing in a much slower fashion than last season. Because of this, they're having fewer opportunities to play through their wingers. Instead, they're playing in a sort of horseshoe fashion, side to side. Declan Rice comes in field, but then distributes it out wide. So what this means is, in terms of the way that they attack, they have the lowest share of chances created in the league from the central third, which is strange and weird. And usually for a very good team, you'd expect that to be high because that's the most obvious route to goal. In fact, around half of their chances actually come from the right third. If you watch them play, you know, they play through Saka a lot and Odegaard's struggling this season. And, these sort of trends aren't just exclusive to sort of Saka and Odegaard. Everyone apart from Saka this season, is producing less XG and less XA. Is it fewer? Per 90. Saka, Martinelli, Jesus, Odegaard, Havertz compared to.
So, but overall, but what the defense has improved at a greater rate than the attack has declined. So overall, they're better.
I wouldn't go that far.
Do Arsenal fans not think they're better this year?
The impression that I get is as a unit, just from seeing Arteta asking, he doesn't seem as content with his team. The defence is excellent, but the fluency and the opportunity to celebrate the best qualities of their players isn't as obvious as before. Usually you would see you'd see more counterattacks playing through Martinelli, through Saka. Of course, Jesus has been injured, but in playing in this particular way, they are sort of inhibiting the opportunity for their best players to play well. And perhaps that is also in part because players like Odegaard aren't playing as well as last season.
Do Arsenal fans just like sort of gloss over the last 4 months of last season when they're making these judgments about their team? Well, they were pretty terrible for the last 4 months of the season, weren't they? They were like ninth, 10th best team in the league, if that.
Yeah, that drop-off was really quite significant. So I think everyone sort of accepts and knows that they were running hot, but their underlying figures were solid.
Yeah, they were great. They were good.
And they're running hot.
It's just that they did no rotation and for like the first 20 league games. And then,
And then it all seemed to sort of fall apart. Given the state of the squad in terms of a number of young players that have developed, so you've got Saka and Martinelli in extra year development. You've got Odegaard also maturing, Declan Rice.
Yeah.
All these players, you expect to see an increase because they're developing into better players and the manager just naturally has more time with them. So you expect to say, these are the baseline figures and this is the improvement. But the improvement is not quite matched up in the areas where you'd think it was. But the flip side is what happens when they do attack well? I think it's reasonable to expect that Saka, Martinelli and co. may create more. That attack has been trending downwards for quite a while now.
Question: Here's the exam question then, Hamza. Right, the attack is trending downwards. We all agree with that. They're a different team. We all agree with that. Is the attack in quotes still good enough to win? Because the defense most definitely is. Is the attack still at a good enough level to win?
If they're this miserly in defense, then yeah. Because, like you said, 17 shots from set pieces is extraordinary. And their ability to suppress shots and limit counter-attacking opportunities is quite good. In an ordinary season...
27 big chances in 12 games. I think it's over two per game in attack. So, but you obviously have to, unfortunately, work with a lot of Arsenal fans. Do you think the Arsenal attack is, in quotes, good enough to win?
I mean, if you look at this is only understat, but they've got they should have scored 23.6 and they've scored 26 goals. So they're sort of overperforming a little bit. But Hamza's right. Their defence is absolutely stonkingly. You know, XGA is 11 and conceded 10, so they're slightly overperformance there. But
yeah, and that's despite having a rubbish goalie.
That is despite having a rubbish goalie. Although the points that Understat have got them at is 22.6.
Yeah.
And Arsenal got 27. So they're actually overperforming in the points direction more than us. Because Understat have got us at 24 points versus 27. So, but the Arsenal fans I work with are delirious. I mean, the end of last season, they were like, oh, we're unlucky and the rest of it. And yeah, they're not very statistically minded, unfortunately. But
just working in the uni, but not
yeah, in the department. A couple of the guys I work with, the other guys that used to work there and moved on would probably agree with Hamza, to be fair. I think that they would always go with the. They're my age, right? So they've grown up with the George Graham Arsenal, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
Defence wins your titles. And from their point of view, though, that group of Arsenal fans I work with are very much like, well, this defence is elite and this could win us a league.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot wrong with that argument, to be fair.
Yeah. Hamza, can you come back to your Man City?
Just before I go to Man City, Arsenal are quite effective on set pieces too. They have the fourth best XG from set plays, 4.49, and scored 8 goals. A bit of an overperformance there. But if you just watch their corners, for example, they target them quite well. Last season, they targeted the front post really, really heavily. And this season, they've changed it. They're actually targeting the back post a lot more. And they do run sort of sequences as well. And they appear to be rehearsed sequences. And I went through quite a few earlier this season. I watched them and they looked like it's like American football style set pieces. Nice. As in the ball
they've
is
been,
in...
They've been on the stats bomb course then. Yeah.
The ball is in open play, but you can see what rehearse moves where a player sees a trigger and attacks a certain space to drag an opponent with them. Often if the ball is on the right side of it for a corner, Zinchenko will come over and sometimes he will attack the half space and he'll try and run into there as a ball is cut back. They have a number of sequences. I did a piece, so I'll share it. So they're quite good.
Are they better than us in attack on set pieces this season, or are we still above them?
We have 4.34 XG and 4 goals in the league. Although we have 9 shots more, we have 59 to their 50.
Okay.
But yeah, I'll jump on to City now. City are interesting. Because if you take a 19 match rolling average, half a season, their XG non-penalty is
in attack
consistent. It's still very, very, very good, but it's just been trending downwards consistently since Haaland arrived, which is notable. It's
counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah. Given that he is also a historic overperformer relative to XG, I guess it's not too big of a deal. But it's just interesting that they now attack in a different way because of Haaland. We suspected it, and now you can see that sort of playing out. And their XG against, again, is still very good. It's below, in non-penalty terms, below 1 per game. But it is slightly trending upwards. But the XG
is it really? No, I didn't know that actually. On City's XG, I thought they were actually static on. So
using this 19 match average,
so they're slightly worse. They're slightly worse at both ends. Okay, over 19 games. Interesting.
Yeah. So the low point that I have them since 2017-18 season is 0.42, an idea that they reached in February 13th, 2021. Previous 19 matches, which is just bonkers.
Yeah.
It's been trending slowly upwards since then, but you wouldn't expect a team to maintain that sort of level. But as we know anyway, below one is fine. Yeah. They are a bit more diverse in their attack than Arsenal. They create 43% of their chances from the middle. The central third of the pitch, and then just under 40 from the left side where Doku is getting involved now. So around 20 on the right, which is interesting. But in terms of preview for Liverpool's match on Saturday, we know that they will attack through the middle and they will attack to the left. But that left side rotation has always been something that they've done. I remember there's a fantastic goal they scored against Manchester United with a pile sort of five players to one side and then switched it to the right to Mahrez. And I think that was in like the second minute of the match. Yeah, best XG difference in the league. They are just a juggernaut, although not as invincible as in previous seasons.
They are still the benchmark. Yeah, they are still the benchmark. And if Rosie was here, he would make a point of still saying that Newcastle are top of both the big chances at both ends. They are joint best with us in attack, and they are easily the best in defence. They've only conceded 10 in 12 games, 10 big chances. So Newcastle, they've had some dodgy results, indifferent results, but they are still a good team statistically.
I can actually explain Newcastle. I did a piece on them.
This is why we've got you on the pod, Hamza.
Because I was doing a sort of title piece and Newcastle kept coming up in the numbers, and I thought I can't put them in the title piece because people can see that and start laughing, like, why have you put Newcastle there? So I did a separate piece examining them, and the key to them essentially is when they have positive game state, they are ruthless. Well, they have been when Callum Wilson and Isak have been playing together. They just rack up chances. Well, the key thing, so this, I did this, let me just check the date on this, was the 4th of November. So it's maybe one game week old because of the international break. And that Newcastle led the league in big chances, 41, and they'd scored 22, 54% conversion rate of their big chances. And when they lead, they typically create chances worth 2.33 XG and face ones worth 0.93.
Oh, so, shit. So that's amazing.
So their XG difference.
So they're good front runners. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Their XG difference when leading is 1.4. Liverpool's is 1.04. Arsenal 0.86. City 0.58. Spurs negative 0.7. But that has to be considered alongside the stat that I just sort of said, that they're converting, they have loads of big chances and they're converting them really, really well. So what they've been able to do is get their shots off early, sit back in their typical block, and then because they've got players that are suited to the counter-attack,
yes.
Isak, Wilson, Almiron, Joe Willock, now he's back, Joe Linton, Anthony Gordon as well, very quick players. So
Plus a big set piece threat as well.
Exactly. Because of that, they're able to break effectively as opponents like come forward, leave space in behind, and that suits them to a T. And if you look at their shot map, we can go and understand. Actually, one thing you may not know, you can Bart knows, you can extract all the shots for a team on understat, even though it doesn't show it on the website. And if you look at their shot map, they have loads right in the middle of the goal, right around the six-yard box, precisely because of that. So they're able to counter-attack really well. And again, these stats are, like I said, game week old.
Yeah.
But Isak and Wilson had the highest XG per 90 rates in the league of players with four 90s or more. Wilson was going at 0.94, Isak 0.84, Nunez was going at 0.83 and Haaland 0.79. So just the context there, that they were both hotter than the two most prolific number nines in the league. So I think that those stats are just a useful bit of context to understanding Newcastle.
Yeah. I mean, that Liverpool win at Newcastle is a monumental result in the context of the season already. Yeah, absolutely brilliant stuff, Hamza. Thank you. So, Si, just coming to you to wrap up, mate. I mean, I know you don't like talking about Arsenal. Maybe we can talk about Hamza instead.
I like to talk about Hamza's awesome, but Newcastle, I'm not having it. I was never having it. It's bullshit. They are wank.
they're not a myth like Spurs.
115 shots that aren't big chances for five goals.
Yeah.
They've scored 27 this season, 22 from big chances.
Yeah.
Like, there's just got so much going their way to create 22 big chances that early. I just think it's a small sample size and
so they set pieces. They get ahead through set pieces and then they
set pieces. Yeah. It's just the run that we had, but we're way better than them. Their most attacking threat is Trippier from corners.
So you think in Newcastle versus Spurs for fourth place, yeah?
No, I think Newcastle are going to finish seventh.
Wow.
I thought this at the beginning of the season. I think.
Wow. Wow. I'm saying Newcastle finishing above Spurs.
Because you like their defence, that's why.
Yeah, because I always like defence, but I'm the only person that's part who values defence.
Yeah, it's just part of our own bias. Against Newcastle their injuries are gonna fall off a cliff.
Is against Jason Tindall.
Oh God, he's a wanker. But no, it's just that they they cheat. And
they really do push the limit, don't they? With
Yeah. They're filthy cheating. I hate it, and it's going to come home to roost because all their players, they haven't got a clue how to keep them on the field.
Yeah,
and more and more of them, they haven't got many good ones anyway. The ones they have, I'm holding my hands up here. It's remarkable how Eddie Howe has got shit players.
Yeah.
To play like they're a top four team when the same shit players were almost getting them relegated.
Yeah. He has completely changed his spots as well. Leopard can change his spots because he went away, he was a long time out of the game, and he has, to be fair, as a coach, completely reinvented himself.
Sean Dyche, you're right.
Yeah, become Sean Dyche, absolutely. But
one more, if you don't mind, just on, yes. on the... Because I mentioned the game state stuff, and again, this data is like slightly old, but accurate enough for general purposes. When trailing, Newcastle create 0.35 XG. So if difference, they create 0.87 and concede 0.52.
Yeah, that's
not
pretty good.
Our XG difference when trailing is 0.83. City's is 1.23. Arsenal's is 1.77. And Spurs is 2. But I think that Spurs one will have changed after the Chelsea match.
Absolutely.
That's
what happened to them last season when teams basically just decided to sit in Newcastle when they went through their bad run in January, February, March, and they couldn't break teams down. So, yeah.
Okay, can I just also say, add on to that, like, great stuff from Hamza, that Arsenal actually have the best big chance conversion in the league. And let me get it up because I just had a sheet of it. So Arsenal, he's right. Up to date data is, he said 54. It's 54.8 for Newcastle because they scored another one, 23 from 42. Arsenal have got 15 from 27. They've only created 27, which is remarkable in itself, but they've got 56% conversion rate. That we, City are 46, we are 45. But let's just delve into the 45.
We've done that already on Mo Salah and Darwin Nunes. We've done that already. Don't be
let's
mean.
Let's just say one player is at 23% and one player is at 71%.
Yes, we weren't deliberately not going to do Darwin on this pod. No, Bart, Newcastle or Spurs, what do you think?
I'd like Spurs to, but I don't particularly want either of them, to be honest with you. I mean,
you'd rather have one of those two than Man United.
For sure, 100%. But there's a lot of sides in and around that same sort of mix. You know, if you look at Understat as well, they've got Villa in at the same sort of points.
Yeah, this is true, actually.
You know, Villa are doing well. They're in line for defensively, underperforming attackingly. That's not a bad place to be for Villa. Considering, as Si always says, beat the dross and you not quite win the league, but you know you do pretty damn well. So I think there are a lot of sides in that sphere. I think personally, I think it's City, Liverpool, and Arsenal are in the top three, and then the fourth place could be one of four sides. I think, to be honest with you, how Newcastle keep managing two games. If they go out of Europe, right, then that actually might help them.
Yeah,
because they won't have those extra times. He doesn't have to worry about the problem he's got at the moment about managing how he plays the players. He'll just play the league.
Well, we've got this block in this block, talking about this block of games. We've got City straight after the international break. We've got Arsenal at home, the last match before Christmas on the 23rd. And then we got Newcastle at home on New Year's Day. So, three big games against
games.
Three of the best teams statistically anyway in that period.
Here's a banter stat to support Man United aren't going to be in that competition. So the lad we're not talking about who's has had 15 big chances this season and scored three of them.
Stop.
No.
Go on.
Hoyland.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Hoyland.
Anthony and Rashford combined have had 15 this season and scored zero.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. But anyway, Thank you very much, Hamza. We do hope you will be able to come back more often.
Thanks for having me. I'll give you a bit more Newcastle if you want.
No, we're finished off for now, but we've already gone over long. This is what we like. Somebody who's come prepared with stacks of material. That is what we like. But yes, please, we'll do everything we can. Give us your feedback on how Hamza did. Everybody, be nice. Or there might be some forced jokes going on. But thank you, Si. Thank you, Bart. And we will be back on Monday for the big one, Man City Liverpool. Until then, up the fucking Reds.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this Anfield Index show. Please be sure to subscribe to our channel so future podcasts find their way to your device automatically. There's nothing quite like fan engagement, and we'd love to know what you think of anything discussed on this show. The best way to get in touch is over on our free Discord community, where both podcasters and listeners debate the hottest LFC topics 24/7. Sign up free now at anfieldindex.com/Discord. You won't regret it. You can also follow us on Twitter at Anfield Index and find us on Facebook by searching for Anfield Index. Oh, and before you go, we'd love it if you could leave us a 5-star review on your favourite podcast app. It only takes a couple of seconds, and it means the world to the people who create these free shows. Sports Social Podcast Network.